From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Breast cancer crusader Dr. Susan Love is going to battle again. This time she's fighting decades-old thinking about early breast cancer detection. The topic's made headlines and made a lot of women nervous in recent weeks with news that a large study in China on breast self-examination found no evidence the monthly ritual reduced death rates. For Dr. Susan Love, the China findings confirm what she's been crying out for a long time, that the medical establishment has been missing the boat on what early detection really is and putting too big a burden on women to find their own cancers. Mammograms and self-examinations, says Love, are really late detection because by the time a lump is found, it could already be cancer. The trick is to marshal resources for technology that could identify problems before they become cancer. In a sharply worded essay in the New York Times, Love warned that to continue promoting self-exams and mammograms is harmful because, quote, they give us a false sense that we have a good way to find cancers and thus cure them. And that very sense may keep us from redirecting resources to find a better approach. Listeners, has all the conflicting news about preventing and treating breast cancer been keeping you awake at night? Does it make you feel helpless? Do you need to believe in self-examination to have something to hang on to? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Joining me tonight from Pacific Palisades, California, is doctor, activist, and writer Dr. Susan Love. In addition to writing op-ed pieces, she has a new book out, the third edition of Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Susan Love.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure to be back, having spent many years in Boston and many years listening to WBUR. It's delightful to be a guest.
It's terrific to have you. There has been so much in the news in recent weeks about breast cancer, and in particular about that long-time standby that women were encouraged to engage in self-examination. Susan Love, why have we heard so much for so long about self-examination when we now hear that it doesn't actually reduce death rates?
Well, I think, first of all, I finally had an epiphany on how to explain this, because I think a lot of people don't really understand the study. So I'm going to back up and do that first. What they were really looking at was whether a formal way of doing breast self-exam, where you're trained and they check up on you and they call you every month and you do the whole song and dance that's on the videos and the shower cards that we women have been bombarded with for years,
right. That
whether that is better than what women normally do, which is just poke around.
And this, of course, was done with almost 250,000 factory workers around Shanghai
Exactly. Over
a long period.
And the reason they did it in China was because they wanted to have a population that really did not have access to mammography and that had never been told or had none of the myths about breast self-exam. And so they were really pretty pure from a scientific standpoint. And you could really test the notion. But I think it's important to point out that most women, including in the control group of this study, find their own cancers.
You've written that women tend to find their own cancers not while they're doing a formal self-examination, but while they're bathing or scratching or with lovers.
That's right, or in the shower, or something feels a little funny, so you poke around. And so, in fact, what they really were doing in the study was comparing the formal public policy training of breast self-exam versus the normal poking around that we all do.
But that doesn't really lessen your critique, Susan Love. You're not happy with self-examination. And if what you're saying is that just poking around is as good as a formal, rigorous routine, that's hardly very comforting about the effectiveness.
No, you're absolutely right. But I wanted to make that point clear, because I think a lot of women that I've come across in the last couple of weeks have felt like what the study was looking at was whether you should touch your breast or never touch your breast. And it really isn't that. It's whether public policy should be promoting breast self-exam as a formal way to train it and teach it and shower cards and the whole bit, or whether women should just be poking around as we've been doing. And in fact, what they showed was the formal training, not only did it not change the death rate of breast cancer, it didn't even find cancers smaller. And in fact, the big problem was the women who did breast self-exam had more benign biopsies than the control group. So it didn't help them and, in fact, may have harmed them.
So there's a lot to look at here, but help us step back just first, because everything seems to have been thrown under a shadow of doubt. And starting with breast self-examination, you're saying then, is it still worthwhile to do it regularly, to do it intensively, or not? If you're an individual woman listening to this show tonight, what's your advice to that woman?
I certainly don't want women to hear that we should never touch our breasts again. Of course we should, and we should get to know our bodies. But formal breast self-exam, they really don't need to do, and most women don't do it, but they feel very guilty that they don't do it. So now they don't have to feel so guilty.
And are you saying that as a matter of public policy or to an individual woman? I mean, couldn't it still happen that in an individual case it might give a woman a heads up to something that otherwise she might not discover for more weeks or months?
Well, what this study is saying is that actually that doesn't happen, mm-hmm. that the woman is just as likely to discover it herself in her normal activities as she is doing breast self-exam.
Take us right on down the list then. Mammography, it also has come under some shadow of doubt about its effectiveness. And yet, millions of women still do it, and we hear medical professionals saying it's still very important to do. Give us the bottom line here.
Well, again, it's a little bit of wishful thinking. Mammography is the reason there's so much controversy is because it's not a great tool. It's okay, but it's not great, and it works best in older women and women over 50. It's mm-hmm. not a good tool in younger women.
Why is that?
It's because younger women have very dense breasts. It's a little, you know, it's why they stick straight out.
The
and,
tissue is more dense, so the mammography is not can't detect as thoroughly?
Well, the breast tissue is white, and the cancer is white, so it's like looking at for a polar bear in the snow. Mm-hmm. You just can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that we're trying to deprive young women of their God-given right to be radiated. It's really that it just doesn't work very well in that population.
But for women 50 and above, you're saying it's still important. Continue to do it.
Yeah, but it's not, again, not perfect. It reduces the risk of dying of breast cancer by about 30%. And that's good. And I'm 55. I get my mammogram. But it's not 100% by any means.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think we've gotten ourselves into trouble about is in the attempt to oversimplify and get sound bites out, we've made it sound as if early detection is the answer, it always works, and if you just do your breast self-exam and get your mammogram, you'll find your cancer early, you'll be cured, and life will be groovy. And it's not that simple.
You go further than that, Susan Love, to say that this is almost a way that the medical establishment has shuffled the burden of responsibility off onto individual women, when in fact it needs to be coming up with better early detection systems itself.
Well, I think that's right. And I don't think it's necessarily a malicious or conscious thing, but I think that it's easy. If we think we have these tools and then we get these messages out, and then we start believing them after a while, and we forget that we, you know, early detection, the original concept of early detection was a marketing message in the 1950s. It was not a scientific concept. Cancers don't grow from a grain of sand to a pea to a grape to a lemon to a grapefruit.
In a gradual progression, in a steady progression.
In a continual progression.
How do they grow?
First of all, they spurt, and they rest, and they spurt, and they rest.
So something could be small and then get much larger, you're saying.
Very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And also, sometimes you can't feel them. What you're feeling or looking at in a mammogram are not the cancer cells. It's the reaction that the cancer cells inspire around them or cause around them. And some cancers cause a lot of reaction when they're very small, and so they're easy to find. And other cancers don't really cause much reaction at all until they're quite large. And so the woman could be doing everything right and suddenly have this orange in her breast and say, you know, where did this come from?
But no one wants to just sit around and wait for that to happen. What's the incidence of breast cancer now among American women, Susan Love?
One in eight. You know,
I mean, that's enormous.
180,000 cases. But it's not a matter of sitting around. It's not like you, in our current techniques, you can find that particular cancer at an earlier point. Some cancers with our current techniques just aren't findable smaller than an orange.
So what should we be doing, or what's underway here? If self-examination isn't enough, if mammograms don't work for many women, especially young women, What are the opportunities?
What we really need to do, I think, is get – there's a lot of people working on other ways to do imaging. You know, and you hear about MRIs and digital imaging and thermography and ultrasound. But I think we need to get beyond imaging, because the problem with imaging is it's looking for cancers that are already there. And we don't really – I don't want to find cancers that are already there. I want to find cells that are just thinking about being cancer someday when they grow up.
That's been done for other cancers. Prostate cancer has a kind of early warning.
But a better example actually would be colon cancer or cervical cancer.
Okay.
Where with colon cancer you can find polyps on colonoscopy and clip them out and prevent colon cancer. With cervical cancer, we find cells that are a little off. I mean, most of the time, and certainly in this country, when you have a pap smear that's abnormal, it's usually not cancer. It's usually just these cells are a little off, and then you have a procedure, and then you're back to normal. So that's what we need to do in breast cancer. We need to get much, much earlier in the process if we're really going to make a dent.
How could that happen?
Aha, I thought you'd never ask. I mean, I've been worrying and thinking and agonizing about this for a long time, since I was in Boston, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And all breast cancer starts in the lining of the milk ducts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so all breast cancer, there are ducts and there's lobules. The ducts are like branches of a tree, and the lobules are like the leaves at the end of the tree.
But and are the milk ducts, the lining of the milk ducts, are spread throughout the breast?
Well, there are 6 to 8 milk ducts, and they're all interspersed through the breast tissue, sort of like the blue lines in a cheese. You know, they're sneaking through it.
Right.
Don't know.
Okay.
That's the perfect example, but it starts in those ducts. So it occurred to me that if milk comes out, what we should be able to go in the other direction. And I started looking into this. I've been a good 15 years ago, and I found, of course, that you're never the first one to have these brilliant ideas.
Hmm.
And one of the first people was, in fact, George Papanicolaou, who invented the pap smear.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1950s, he was squeezing breasts and getting a drop of fluid out to see whether he could find abnormal cells.
And did he?
Yes.
Well, then why aren't we just doing that instead of all this?
Well, because he didn't know what to do about it. It was the 1950s, and the only treatment was a radical mastectomy, and you weren't about to just do a radical mastectomy for abnormal cells, so they didn't know how to deal with that. So
are you saying that right now women could be having some fluid drawn from the breast that would indicate yay or nay whether they had or were likely to get breast cancer?
Well, yes and no. It's not totally, it's not quite that simple. But indeed, we have a way now to even go further than that, but to put a little catheter into a milk duct, squirt in some salt water, smush it around a bit, suck it out, and look at the cells under the microscope, and we get 10,000 cells. This is called ductal lavage.
Ductal lavage.
Wash out the duct.
Is it widely practiced or practiced at all as early warning?
It's FDA approved. It's being practiced around the country in a number of places. It's been around for about a year. Right now, it's really being used mostly recommended for high-risk women, women who have breast cancer in one breast, and want to check out the other breast.
Why women, just for high-risk women if all women are at significant risk?
Right. But the reason is if you have a typical, you know, the question becomes, okay, so if you find, it's the same question Papanicolaou had. If you find atypical cells, if you find these cells that are just thinking about becoming cancer,
mm-hmm.
what do you do? And in the high-risk woman, we have several options. You could take tamoxifen, which is an estrogen blocker,
right,
and will help block those atypical cells.
Mm-hmm.
You could, if you were, you know, had breast cancer in one breast, some women think about having preventative mastectomies on the other breast.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe instead they could monitor it with ductal lavage, and if they started to get funny-looking cells, then they would decide to do that. Now, the problem is we're doing cytology. We're looking at it under the microscope,
mm-hmm.
and it's not perfectly accurate. It's a little bit like looking at a lineup at the police station and guessing the criminal by how they're dressed.
And just who is just how dangerous. Susan Love, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk about exactly how this might work and how women are dealing with the reality of the breast cancer threat today. We're talking about breast cancer and the difficulty of finding it early enough. What is a woman to do? Women, do you feel helpless when it comes to effective early detection? Do you still self-examine, or did a study in China make you stop? This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University,
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about breast cancer and the difficulty of finding it, detecting it early enough. Women, how far would you be willing to go to test for early signs of breast cancer? And do you still do self-examination even after the study in Shanghai that said it may not cut death rates? You can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. My guest tonight is Dr. Susan Love. She's author of Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book. It's now out in its third edition. She's an adjunct professor of surgery at UCLA Medical School. Susan Love, you were saying just before the break that there is new technology coming in here, ductal lavage, which would be a kind of, as I understand it, of pulling cells from the breast through the nipple, I guess, and then examining those to see if they give early warning signs of potential cancer risk. But once those warning signs are found, then you say the question is what to do.
Right. And what I was saying is that in high-risk women, we have some options. But in the average woman who of average risk, we really don't quite know. We run the risk. It's the same risk we have with the PSA test or with a lot of these screening tests, that not everybody who has atypical cells is going to go on to cancer. Only probably about a third of them.
So then here we have
over-treating people.
And well, there you have early detection, but you don't know what to do with it. How does that advantage us?
Well, because at the moment, as Dr. Lavage, for high-risk women, has some options. You've got tamoxifen, you've got prophylactic mastectomy. It's pretty drastic, but you at least have some choices. And it's really being used in women who are trying to make decisions about these choices. The exciting part about it, though, is the access it gives us to where breast cancer starts. And now I have a nonprofit foundation, and we're funding a lot of research to look for some markers, to look for protein marker in the fluid, to look for maybe changes in the DNA of the cells, so that it will be more accurate than just looking at the cells under the microscope. And then, you know, we'll start to get to a test which really will work for all women.
Now, I guess I should point out at one time you helped found a company that makes medical devices that would do this ductal lavage. Is that right?
I did indeed. I've been working on this for a long time, and I've had government grants, and then I decided the fastest way to do it was to start a company, and I started a company called Product Health that makes the catheter. That was acquired by actually a Boston company called Cytec, and I still consult for Cytec.
So you have an interest there, but even given that interest, can you imagine a day at which this becomes standard procedure for women, and women of what ages?
Well, my fantasy is that we find a protein or something in the fluid, and then what we would do as a standard for all women is we would massage our breasts, squeeze a little bit, get a drop of fluid out, which you can do in most women, dipstick it. If it turns blue, then you'd go to the doctor. We'd go duct to duct, figure out which duct was abnormal. And then, in my fantasy, we'll squirt a treatment down the duct, and you'll be back to normal.
That means a treatment that would deal with the precancerous condition.
That would deal with those cells, yes.
Wow, that sounds like a dream. Susan Love, stand by. I want to welcome tonight Diane Larkin, and she's joining us tonight from Kent, Washington. Diane Larkin and her daughter were both diagnosed in 2001 with breast cancer. Good evening and welcome, Diane Larkin.
Good evening. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so much for being with us. Diane Larkin, Susan Love is looking forward to a day when we have much better technology for discovering and treating cancer. You and your daughter in 2001 were dealing with a very immediate reality where that technology was not at hand. How did you discover the breast cancer? How did you discover that you each had it? And how have you dealt with it?
Well, my daughter discovered hers first, and again, it was through self-examination. She was just home from her honeymoon. She was 31 years old, too young to have mammograms, and I had encouraged her to do self-examination every month. And Of course, when she discovered this lump, we all thought that it would probably be benign because of her age. Mm-hmm. She ended up going for a mammogram, and like Dr. Susan Love said, the cancer did not show up on her mammogram because of dense breath.
The polar bear and the snow problem.
Mm-hmm. However, the ultrasound made it look more suspicious. So at that time, she had a core biopsy. And when they got the results back of the core biopsy, they said that it was benign. However, the surgeon did give her the option of removing the lump and having an excisional biopsy, which she immediately decided to do. She just didn't like the idea of leaving this lump.
Right.
And upon examining it after they removed it, they discovered that it was invasive ductal carcinoma. And the only explanation we were given as to why that didn't show up in the first biopsy was possibly because the tumor was too hard and the instrument that they were using did not penetrate the tumor.
Bounced mm-hmm. off of it, yeah.
But your daughter must be glad that she did the self-examination that discovered, that got her aware that there was a problem.
Oh, she's very glad. And I'm very glad, too, because until they do come up with something that's going to be better, I mean, I'm all for what Dr. Susan Love said, that maybe we need a completely new technology, but we don't have that. And so in the meantime, especially for young women under 40, if we tell them that by the time you discover the cancer, it's been there too long, and it's not going to have an effect on your life expectancy, I think the message we're giving them is by the time you feel it, you're going to die. It's too late. So what if they all stop doing it? Then what else do they have?
Susan Love.
Well, two things. One is when we say it's not going to affect, it's not going to have a difference in your life expectancy, that doesn't mean you're going to die. It means some cancers are, you know, we're never going to kill you anyway. And so it could be that. It could be just as well that you're going to live as you're going to die. But I'm not saying, I have never said, and I'm not saying don't touch your breast, don't check out anything you find. Mm-hmm. Absolutely you should do that. What we're saying, though, is that breast self-exam, as opposed to just, you know, being aware of your body, formal breast self-exam is really not any better. Mm-hmm. That's all. And so, indeed, your daughter did exactly the right thing, and I think a very important message for women is if you think there's something wrong and you really, you just, there's some sense that it's not right, you need to keep pursuing it, just as she did.
Diane Larkin, you discovered your own breast cancer in that same year. How did that happen, and were you successful in treating it?
I hope I was. I discovered my cancer about the same time, again by feeling a lump. I went directly to a breast surgeon because in the past I had had a benign breast lump removed, and I sort of felt that if I went to my regular doctor, he would refer me anyway, so I just bypassed that.
Mm-hmm.
And my mammogram also did not show anything because even though I'm older, mm-hmm. I apparently still have dense breast.
Mm-hmm.
And the ultrasound made it look like a cyst. So I was advised just to watch it for six
Boy.
Months. And that's what I was doing when Kelly was diagnosed. If it wasn't for Kelly's diagnosis, I don't think I would have, I couldn't have had a biopsy because I've since learned that women can insist on that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, I guess I was reluctant. I felt I was going to a very good doctor, and she felt comfortable in waiting and watching it. However, when I went back 4 months later, deciding not to wait the 6 months, again, I don't think she was really going to biopsy this lump until she realized I was Kelly's mother.
But your daughter's problems got everyone motivated to get more focused here.
Right. And then upon doing a biopsy, which was so quick in the office, it maybe took her 5 minutes to do this procedure. And it turned out that, indeed, I had the same thing that Kelly had. My cancer, they tell me, is a stage one.
Mm-hmm.
The indications are that it had not spread to my lymph nodes.
Mm-hmm.
And at the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance here in Seattle, my oncologist, Dr. Julie Grelo, has told me I have a 95% chance of not getting breast cancer again. So
That's
do
great.
Hope that those figures are right, and I'm very glad that I pursued it and that I did the self-examination.
Diane Larkin, thank you for sharing your story with us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Listeners, we are with Dr. Susan Love tonight. Pam is on the line. Welcome, Pam. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi.
Dr. Love, I have to thank you for everything you've done. I am a stage 4 survivor. I was diagnosed in 1991 with stage 4 cancer and metastasized to my hip. I had been following, I had a tumor that was followed for 4 or 5 years by mammography, ultrasound, repeatedly, religiously, it constantly came up negative. Finally, in February of 91, my primary care physician sent me in for a biopsy. The surgeon who did the biopsy, as it, just when he was doing the pre-op work, he said to me, this does not look like cancer. We're going, we'll do it anyway, but he said, I've never seen a tumor like this. When I came out of the anesthesia, he said exactly the same thing. He said, this doesn't look like cancer. It looks benign, but we'll call you with the results. He called me the next day. It was a Friday afternoon. I remember it vividly. It was February 15th, 1991 at 2 p.m. I was putting my coat on to go for a walk. And I should also point out, I was in my late 40s at the time. I'm very strong, very healthy. I eat all the right foods. I kept saying, oh, this couldn't be cancer. I do everything that I'm supposed to do, so I know it's not cancer. So I was never worried. I had my coat on. I was heading out the door when the phone rang, and the doctor was just absolutely beside himself.
Pam, did you feel well served by the medical system in that discovery or not?
I did. Actually, that's the irony of the thing. I never felt let down by the medical profession. I felt that they were using all of the tools that they had, but I always felt that they were very primitive. And the awful thing is that in 11 and a half years, I haven't seen much progress.
That's right. This is the problem. I want to ask one thing. Was it a lobular cancer? Do you know the kind?
Pam, do you know, was it lobular?
I think it was invasive ductal.
Mm-hmm. Because it would, sounds like you had a pretty sneaky cancer. You
it was
had
big,
a kind.
Too. It was a real big tumor.
Right, but it was sneaky. I mean,
yes.
It was there, but
yep.
it obviously yep. didn't feel like a cancer to the
Correct.
Doctor.
Correct.
Even when he was operating on it.
Correct.
Is this common, Susan Love, to have women going through all these months or even years of uncertainty about whether they even have a tumor or not?
Well, there are some cancers that are pretty easy to pick up, and there are other cancers that are very sneaky, and they're very subtle, and they're not so easy to pick up. And sometimes you can even, as Kelly did, have a biopsy and still not be sure you got it. So this it really is a great example, and it's exactly what she's saying, of how crude our tools are. You know, when we're talking about finding breast cancers, we are in the, you know, not quite the dark ages, but almost.
Pam, thanks for your call, but let me ask you about that, Dr. Susan Love. How can that be? Why should that be? We're constantly told we live in a land of the most sophisticated medical technology in the world, certainly in history. There's clearly been a lot of attention paid to breast cancer. Has it not been enough? Has it been shortchanged on resources? Or why are we still in a primitive state?
Well, it's a combination of things. I mean, one is I think it's that we have oversold what we can do. And we've certainly presented it with all the pink ribbon campaigns and everything else as if we already have the answers. And I think women, we have not made it clear that not every cancer can be found at a good stage, and that some are pretty sneaky, and they're going to sneak in there even when you're doing everything right. And by the same token, I think we have not really been able to get reliably to where breast cancer starts before.
Is that because we haven't applied enough resources and man and woman hours to that project, or is it because somehow the environment is creating cancers faster than we can beat them back?
No, I think that it takes some innovative thinking, and we haven't had a lot of that. So we've been doing, you know, we've put most of our efforts in building a better mammogram or a better way of imaging cancers that are already there, as opposed to getting earlier in the process.
It would seem like high time to do better. Ava's on the line. Welcome, Ava. You're on the air.
Yeah, Ava Bellamy here. How are you?
Very well,
actually,
thanks.
Dr. Love has had a consultation with my daughter. My daughter and I both have had breast cancer, the carcinoma type first, 8 years ago. And I found hers because she asked me, Mom, I feel like I have something. I found hers, and it was, caught, and she had a mastectomy. Well, she was only 33.
Oh,
a couple of years, about 3 years later, I found mine. And like this other woman, they kept telling me, watch it. Do you know how difficult it is to get early detection, even with the crude tools that they have today?
You're right.
They make you wait and wait and wait. I had ultrasound. I had MAMS. I had this. I had that. I had the aspiration type of thing. It didn't come out. It was too hard. Finally, I said, well, look, you know, go in there and check it out. So they, and sure enough, it was carcinoma. They took it out. It was an early stage mine because I'm very, I pretty much know what's going on with my body. You know, mm-hmm. even, by the way, I'm 66 years old.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now I find myself with inflammatory cancer again.
Is this a breast cancer also, Ava?
No, this is the second. Listen to this, though. For since last October, I've had three MAMs. I have to beg, I said, humor me. Give me a mammogram. I have something wrong with my breast.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm going to die. My underarm is sore, and they're saying to me, well, you know, you have from the original lumpectomy. I decided not to remove my breast because
mm-hmm.
they didn't tell me I should. They said it would be the same thing. It's mm-hmm. little, blah, blah.
It is the same thing.
So I went ahead, and this is, you know, from your old alma mater here in Boston.
Right.
But at any rate, I finally... You know, begged. I said, humor me and give me an ultrasound. They didn't know it was normal. Mams were normal. This was normal.
Yeah.
My breast was huge. My breast was red, and my breast was hot. And I had an underarm huge thing, almost like a flat lemon.
And were you being told that you had a problem or not?
No. Listen to this. I finally went back to the breast surgeon at Brigham and Women, the one of the best guys there. He says to me, well, he says, you know, I said, touch it. It's hot. He says, nah, feels right to me. My own doctor keeps, I said, can't you see, can't you look at it? It's purple.
Ava, let's get Susan Love's response. Susan Love, is this a common story? It doesn't sound like it should be.
Well, it's not a common story, but what she had was another one of the sneaky ones. She had inflammatory breast cancer, which presents as a red, hot, inflamed breast. It never has a lump that you can see on a mammogram. It's not something you can see on an ultrasound, and you can't feel, you know, it's not a lump you can feel. It's the whole breast that becomes inflamed with the cancer, and it's a very aggressive kind of breast cancer. And it again, it's, you know, one that you really can't get much earlier. Now, I actually give you a lot of credit, Eva, because you're doing exactly what women and all the women listening have to hear. If you have something and you know there's something wrong, you just have to keep beating on them till somebody responds. And if, you know, the doctor doesn't respond, you go find another doctor. But you know your body better than anybody else.
Ava, thank you for your call. We're talking tonight about breast cancer and the difficulty of finding it early enough. There's been so much news about things that don't work. We're looking for hope tonight. We're looking to the future. But we're also looking at what people can do right now. What do you think? Has breast cancer received sufficient funding and attention from the medical community? Do you ever look, after you hear all these stories, do you look at your own breasts as enemies? Do you need to believe in self-examination to have something to hang on to here? What about mammograms? Listeners, get into the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. We're talking with Dr. Susan Love, author of Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about breast cancer and the difficulty of finding it early enough. My guest tonight is Dr. Susan Love. She's author of Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book and medical director of the Susan Love MD Breast Cancer Foundation. It's a nonprofit organization dedicated to the eradication of breast cancer. She's joining us tonight from Pacific Palisades, California. You can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Women, do you feel essentially helpless when it comes to early, effective detection of breast cancer? And men, do you know how to have a conversation with the women in your life about breast cancer? Jack is on the line. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a physician, and, you know, breast cancer is a very emotion-laden diagnosis and
mm-hmm.
carries a lot of weight for a lot of women. But
mm-hmm.
the point I wanted, a couple points I wanted to make. One was that the notion that physicians don't recognize breast cancer and that it's an underfunded diagnosis is really kind of unfair
You think it's had all the attention it deserves, Jack, or what's your view?
I think so, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of different cancers out there. Mm-hmm. And a woman's chances of dying lung cancer are higher than her chances of dying of breast cancer. And colon cancer is getting ahead of breast cancer also in mm-hmm. terms of female mortality. Mm-hmm. Our treatments and our diagnostic strategies for, all cancers have not gotten very far in the last 10 to 20 years. So it's not really just breast cancer that there aren't a lot of new options for. It's really all cancers.
Susan Love, how about it? Are we overly romantic or carried away when it's breast cancer because of all the maternal associations? Are we making too much of this one cancer when it's all cancers that are really frustrating medical science?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I think that breast cancer it hits at a much earlier age than mm-hmm. a lot of the other cancers. And it certainly takes women out in their prime of life very often. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely true that lung cancer kills more women, and there's no question that we need to be working and are working very hard about the whole smoking issues and at finding something better for that as well. We have the same problem with lung cancer and many cancers where we don't have access to where they start. We've got, better options, really, with cervical and colon cancer because we can get there.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have a lot of research money. In 1990, when we started the advocacy movement for breast cancer, there really was very little research money. But it's been very successful, and we've got lots of money. I think, though, that sometimes we don't really spend it very wisely. We spend it at just doing what we're doing now slightly better instead of really trying to make some big leaps into completely new ways of doing things.
You ready for that quantum leap? Jack, thank you for your call. I want to welcome onto the show now Judy Foreman. She's a nationally syndicated medical journalist who I've known for a long time. Good evening and welcome, Judy Foreman.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Susan, too.
Hi.
Hi, Judy. Judy, you've been listening, and you have listened for years to the debate over different ways of detecting breast cancer and to women's laments about how difficult it is. What is your sense about where this whole conversation stands now? The headlines, you can just look on the internet, and day after day the headlines are there. Some new wrinkle on the breast cancer concern and detection front. Do we have ourselves worked into a swivet here over something that we just can't do anything about? Or is it right that we should be standing back a little bit from the self-examination path that we've been on and saying we've got to have something radically better?
I think kind of both. I agree with your previous caller, Jack, the physician, that it's wrong to say that breast cancer has been underfunded. I mean, if you look at the money and where it gets spent, I think women have done a terrific job of lobbying for lots of money for breast cancer, and other cancers don't have quite the bright, young, articulate, media-savvy cheerleaders that the breast cancer advocacy people have. And that's too bad because other cancers kill people too. Heart disease kills even more women than breast cancer. So I think breast cancer is getting as much attention politically as it should, but I don't think the money that is being given for breast cancer is going to the right places. I mean, I think that's where I really agree strongly with Susan Love.
Why would that be, Judy? Why would it be misdirected? What forces would be pushing it off of the best target?
Because I think women have basically been misled in a way, or maybe it's not quite that evil, but I think we have sort of done these campaigns, stride out for breast cancer, walk for breast cancer, wear your little pink mm-hmm. ribbons, get your mammogram, and, as we've discovered, that's completely inadequate. We should be lobbying for molecular biologists to find really precise tests for breast cancer. I don't know if the ductal lavage thing will really work, but things like that, blood tests, to catch the cancers earlier, that's what we really need. But 10 years ago, the science wasn't there to back that idea, and the political sophistication wasn't there to back that idea.
Maybe it's coalescing now. Judy, Susan Love, stand by. I want to take another call. Cece's on the line. Hi, Cece. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Well, thanks.
How you doing, Susan?
Hi.
I hear you want to talk about eradication, but I do notice that most of this phone call is about the recognition and then the cure. And this is a point of, ethics, and you mentioned truth in the beginning of the show mm-hmm. over research and cure.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to just rant down this for about a minute, and then I'll give you time.
We'll give you half that, but go.
Half that. Okay, why look at the cures, tests, treatments, and not the root causes? What about the industry-related root causes? Where are the hot spots? Do these documents exist?
Hotspots? You mean what do you mean? Environmental hotspots?
No,
toxic?
Women who get breast cancer somewhere around the nation or in the country or in the world, when that happens, is there a little dot on a map? And what industry is around that? What wind, groundwater can this travel? Point is, are we creating tomorrow's cancers today?
So you're pulling us up to the environmental issue.
Yes, environmental. Are we breathing it, eating it? Is it coming out of our smokestacks? Are we creating it in labs?
Well, Cece, thanks for that observation. Susan Love, what about it? If we want to get to real early detection, do we have to go all the way to that environmental level?
Well, I think it's a combination. I mean, I think on the one hand, if we want to, you know, find things as early as we can and get to where it starts, but we also want to not have it happen in the first place. And we've not been, I mean, there have been big research studies and looking at the environment, and we haven't found a smoking gun yet. Mm-hmm. I think part of the problem is we may not be looking at the right things because we, you know, it's like that guy looking for his keys under the lamppost. He's looking under the lamppost because that's where the light is, but he lost them up the street.
But yet we do see these this clustering of breast cancer incidents.
Yeah, the clustering right now, you know, breast cancer is one of those interesting diseases that is most common in high socioeconomic white women. It is less common in poor white women. It's less common but more deadly in African-American women, less in Hispanic women, Asian. And it's the same thing with countries. It's very common in the first world, you know, highly developed countries, and less common in the third world. The Asian countries have been pretty low, and they're coming up to our level. So some of it is, some of the hotspots are actually track very well with socioeconomic level. Now, why is high socioeconomic level a risk factor? That is, we know a little bit. Part of it is that the younger you are with your first pregnancy, the lower your risk. And so
more affluent women are having children later.
Women have children later. But that's not enough to explain the whole thing. So there is still a lot of questions. And it's interesting. I mean, obviously my bias is if we can get in the milk ducts, we'll find some answers. But they've found pesticides in the milk ducts. They've found nicotine in the milk fluid in non-breastfeeding women. And so it may be that one of the problems is we've been looking in the blood for these things. Maybe we really need to be looking at the fluid that's bathing the cells that become cancer. And we really don't know what the non-breastfeeding breast does. We don't have a clue what the normal breast does. Does it concentrate? You know, if you're breastfeeding and you have a glass of wine, your kid goes to sleep, gets right in the breast milk. What about when you're not breastfeeding? We don't know whether things are concentrated, whether they're absorbed, what's metabolized. Nobody's ever done that research.
Judy Foreman, with all the news that's come out about the ineffectiveness of self-examination, we only have 30 seconds left, but what's your sense of how women are responding? Are they letting it go, or are they still doing it because they don't know what else to do?
Frankly, I don't think that's a big issue. I think they're much more concerned with the mammography issue and hormone replacement. I think breast self-exam is sort of a private thing. You can do it. It has no political ramifications. There's, I disagree with Susan Love. I don't think there's big harm. There's only harm in thinking that if you're doing that, you're safe.
Actually, most women, there are studies, most women have never done it in the first place. I mean, 90% of women don't do it.
Well,
so.
Well, then we've definitely got to have something better than that.
The nice thing is they don't have to feel guilty anymore.
Yeah, I guess not. Susan Love, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
And Judy Foreman, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Judy Foreman is a nationally syndicated medical journalist, and Susan Love is author of Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book. You can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, capturing the battle against breast cancer on film. This is On Point. Elsa Dorfman is a photographer who has captured a wide range of emotions on her wide-angle lens, but never something quite like this. 4 years ago, when her friend Debbie Dorsey was diagnosed with cancer, Elsa did a photo shoot with Debbie and two other breast cancer patients. The photo shoot became the documentary No Hair Day that aired on PBS. In this radio diary, Elsa Dorfman reflects on that day and where the battle against breast cancer stands now.
By the time we got together and we got to my studio, it was like 11:45, and so we started off by getting pizza, and then I took a picture of us eating pizza, and then sort of I didn't have any idea what the next picture would be, but between the three of us, we sort of thought, oh, we'll do this, we'll take our hats off, we'll do it with hats, we'll do it without hats. I think the picture that was the most wrenching for me and for them was when they showed the lumpectomy and mastectomy scars and reconstruction. I think we were on such a high, because don't forget, we didn't know what was going to be the next picture. We were completely winging it. So I think we all knew that we were having this incredible experience. And I think there was more wonder than humor in it. You know, it was more, they were in wonder that they had taken off their shirts and they had taken off their wigs and that they were laughing and having fun. And I was in wonder that it was all happening and the camera wasn't breaking. I mean, I really thought they were better looking without hair than with hair. And they were fabulous. I mean, I loved them. They were beautiful. And, you know, one of them has died. Carol, the one that had the reconstruction, whose mother had had breast cancer. She died a year ago exactly. It feels like there hasn't been enough progress. There's a PSA test for men for prostate cancer, but there isn't a PSA test equivalent for women in breast cancer. And Carol was really zapped with an awful lot of chemicals. And that's very infuriating. I sometimes worry that the movie, the book, the photographs aren't angry enough. I'm sort of in the irritated phase of, why aren't we getting more action? Breast cancer isn't even considered a chronic disease yet. I mean, it's not 100% fatal, obviously, but, you know, it's not considered, oh, I have breast cancer and tomorrow I'll be back at work. Debbie Dorsey and I gave a talk in Newton, and there was this woman, young, who was, like, wearing a yellow slicker and very perky, and she had come all the way from Jamaica Plain on her bike, and she was in the middle of chemotherapy. So, of course I said I would take her picture. I took her picture on her bike. You know, it was a great picture. I knew when I did those pictures that I had just done the greatest thing of my career. I mean, I knew that I was at the high point of my career and that that was a day that would never be replicated. And I might as well relax and enjoy the rest of my work life, but I was never going to turn out 12 pictures as good as those pictures. And I thought those women were so beautiful. I mean, I basically did it to make them happy, to make them feel good.
Photographer Elsa Dorfman spoke to us from her studio in Cambridge, Massachusetts. To view her photos, visit elsa.photo.net. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Kelly Jones, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Tim Skog, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Darren Manoogian, Oliver Reed, and Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.